So welcome to Dakota Midday. I am Lori Walsh, and Governor Dennis Dugard is joining us today from Pierre. We have got plenty to talk about, so let's jump right in. Governor Dugard, welcome back to Dakota Midday.
Thank you. Good to be on.
I want to go ahead and start with the Helmsley Charitable Trust and this new announcement of a mental health task force. I just want to read something that you wrote in your column. According to a recent survey, South Dakota has a high prevalence of undiagnosed and untreated depression, as well as a very high prevalence of post-traumatic stress disorder and anxiety. 87% of survey respondents reported receiving all needed medical care, but only 64% reported receiving all needed mental health care. Just 54% received all needed substance use care. Governor Dugard, what were your thoughts when you first saw those sort of numbers?
Well, in some ways, they were not a surprise to me. I guess we've been aware in South Dakota that we have, in a rural state, with a number of areas that are fairly remote from the population centers where we have health care, that distance is a factor in getting physical health access to physical care. Even more so, it's a problem getting access to professionals who can help with mental health needs. And so it wasn't a surprise, but it's something we have to deal with as a rural state.
And so tell me about what happens next. Now, this grant is more than $302,000. Where is that funding going to go?
Well, much of that will go to the organization that has been helping us in the past, this Criminal Justice Institute. It's a nonprofit organization that works with states and other organizations to help them with criminal justice issues. The same office was funded by the Pew Charitable Trust several years ago when we initiated the reform of our adult correction system. So we became acquainted with their capabilities, and they are impressive. They do the crunching of all the numbers. They collect the numbers. In the case of this mental health initiative, we've got to collect data from the unified judicial system. We've got to collect data from the major counties. We've got to look at the state's resources, the numbers of medical health professionals, where they're located. This Criminal Justice Institute will bring people to South Dakota to do all that data assembly and then analyze it and present it to the work group. So the work group begins with not a discussion of what policy changes should be undertaken, but first what is, rather than what should be. And having all the policy makers on this task force start from an examination of facts is very important, to have them be able to discuss policy proposals that maybe they could consider once they understand what is.
So your goal right now is just to gather the information that you need to help make some maybe even sweeping reforms. Are you thinking ahead at all to what that the potential impact of this could be statewide?
Well, again, that's the kind of thing I try to guard against. The natural inclination is to think of solutions to a perceived problem. And, of course, the perceived problem here is we have people with mental health issues coming into contact with the criminal justice system. And at various points along the way, as they participate in the system, their mental health issues are going to present difficulties that wouldn't otherwise be presented. The first instance would be, are they competent to, or do they have a mental health diagnosis that will enable them to participate in the judgment of whether to plead or not, and how they would plead? Can they even have the requisite mental state to have the intent for a crime that requires intent as one of the elements of proof that must be shown by the prosecutor? So things like that, you need right from the outset. You need to judge the mental health of the accused. So, and that's just one example.
I'm wondering if, let's just switch gears a little bit and talk about Chief Justice David Gilbertson. You have worked closely with him on this and other other issues. What is that collaboration like? What is your relationship like with him?
Well, I must say, first of all, it is unusual to have a Chief Justice of a state Supreme Court to be as engaged in policymaking as our Chief Justice is. And so we are very lucky in South Dakota to have a man of the caliber of David Gilbertson and his willingness to not only himself engage, but to involve members of the UJS, Unified Judicial System, other justices, other judges. Of course, the Chief Justice is responsible for the entire judicial branch, not just the five Supreme Court justices in Pierre, but also every judge that sits on the bench anywhere in South Dakota. So he's got a big job already just in dealing with the cases that come before him and his courts. But to have him engage in policy considerations and reform is really unique. Not a lot of states have a justice that's willing to do that. So I'm very grateful to our Chief Justice. He's a great guy.
Yeah. Is that an indication of your relationship with him?
We have a very good relationship, I think it's a pretty two-way street. He works hard to maintain a relationship with me, and I work hard to maintain a relationship with him, because we know that if we maintain a good relationship, then it's to the benefit of our state. So
let's try
to keep it that way.
Let's talk a little bit about Medicaid expansion. Is the clock ticking on that as we move closer to a presidential election and the potential of a change in administration nationally?
It's certainly a factor. As you know, the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services issued their state health official letter on February 26th. And on that date, that was a Friday, or maybe that's a Monday. Friday, we found out about it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, we had literally 6 days left in the legislative session, excluding days when only conference committees and vetoes may be considered. So at that point, of course, when you get a 7-page letter, single-spaced, from a federal agency talking about a major policy change that impacts states nationwide, there's really no time to lay all that out for the legislators, have them be able to analyze it even while they're dealing with all the issues that are coming to a head in those final days of session. It just wasn't realistic to say I would be able to ask for them to give thoughtful consideration to the policy changes or the legislative proposals that I might offer for their consideration. So, as you know, I announced that we would not try to go for a vote on Medicaid expansion during the regular session. That being said, now we're working hard to judge the fiscal impact of those policy changes, and some of them we could and did start analyzing before the letter came out, because we had a sense of what the policy changes would be. In other situations, they had really gone back and forth on some areas. For example, when a Native American gets access to long-term care, and if they go through their Indian Health Service physical health provider, who then in turn says, Dennis, really your physical health is such and your mental state is such, your frailty is such that you no longer are able to care for yourselves, and we recommend you go to a nursing home. Now, does that mean, CMS, we asked, does that mean that they would be eligible for 100% reimbursement if that person was Medicaid eligible? And at first they said yes, then they said no, then they said yes, then they said no. So it really wasn't until the letter came out that we knew the answer was yes. All that being said, then, what about if Dennis goes straight to the nursing home because Dennis's son or daughter says, Dad, you can't take care of yourself anymore. We're taking you to the nursing home. And I don't go through Indian Health Services. Does that qualify? No. The answer is no. no 100% reimbursement there. So the very fact that Native Americans could go directly to a nursing home with the support of their family and not access the nursing home after a first consultation with Indian Health Services will make the difference between whether the state gets 100% reimbursement or about 50% reimbursement.
Are we looking at a special session at some point then, or is that off the table now?
No, it's not off the table. We are doing the analysis that I mentioned earlier. We have our coalition, Health Care Solutions Coalition, has broken out into a number of subgroups. Telehealth is one. We talked just a minute ago about behavioral health. That's another. This long-term care is a third. Those subgroups are looking at what will it take to implement these policy changes in these various areas in South Dakota, and how much dollar savings might be found in each of those categories, and when will those dollar savings be findable? In other words, will they be findable in fiscal year 17, in part, in whole, or will we get some of it in 17 and then more of it in 18? And so really, it's a much more complex analysis than one might think.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hopeful we'll have that analysis within the next month or so to judge whether or not it's feasible to go to the legislature and ask for approval. Then I need to decide, okay, when do I do that? Do I do that before the primary election? Do I do it after the primary election? Do I have the votes? Do I have a chance at having the votes? If the votes are not going to be there, is it wiser to not turn a leaning no vote into a decidedly no vote? Or would it be better to wait until the 2017 session and have a new legislature? Some change faces and maybe re-examine whether the votes are there. If I wait, what about the change in the federal administration? Will that make it more difficult to maintain an expansion or not? Well, you know, so there's a lot of moving parts here. I need to weigh all of them, but there's nothing I can do until the financial analysis is completed, and then we'll look at that and then judge whether, and if so, when to have a special session. But it's definitely a possibility yet.
Let's talk about national politics a little bit. You're the chairman of the South Dakota delegation to the Republican National Convention. How closely are you watching this race and the possibility for a really interesting Republican National Convention?
Well, I watch it. I watch the state returns as each state has their respective caucuses or primary votes, and I watch the delegate count. One thing I'm a little bit disappointed, the national media is a little bit sloppy about being specific about when a candidate wins a state. They're all about the simple answer. Mm-hmm. Dennis got 51% of the vote. Lori got 49%, so Dennis won the state. Well, what does that mean? Does that mean I get all the delegates? Or do I get 51% of the delegates and Lori gets 49%? Or did I win some statewide delegates and I win others district by district? And the national government, or not the national government, the national media is a little bit lackadaisical about specificity, which is, to me, a little bit annoying. Some of them are better than others, though. If you were willing to wade through an hour-long political program, they will generally get to that, but you have to wade through quite a bit. And the print media often doesn't do it either, so that's a little bit of a disappointment. But it's interesting to me, and it seems more and more possible that we'll get to the Republican convention and not have anyone, Donald Trump, not have the requisite majority number to get the nomination on the first ballot.
So then, and what's your role then if that happens as the South Dakota delegate chairman?
Right. Well, as in South Dakota, as you know, we're bound by law to support the winner of the South Dakota primary, all of us. So it's a winner-take-all primary state. So if South Dakota voters, Republican voters, choose candidate A with 51%, or a plurality, I should say, because there'll be more than two candidates. Whoever gets the most votes, the plurality, then every one of us are bound to vote for that candidate on the first ballot. So, again, if there's three candidates and one of them gets 34%, they'll get 100% of the delegates. Now, if on the first ballot there aren't enough to reach the 1,200, whatever it is, number, then after that, the delegates are unbound, and each delegate will have the opportunity to cast their ballot for whom they wish.
Each individual delegate. So all our individuals from South Dakota.
Right. My job really as the chairman, is more honorary than it is functional. I'm the guy that announces the vote.
Okay.
But I don't tell anybody what to do. I don't coordinate anything, really, other than the meetings, and probably help explain.
So once if all our South Dakota delegates are then unbound, do we still try to coordinate as a state, or does everybody just go do what their conscience says?
It'll probably be more up to each person. They're like a legislature in that sense. They each have their own vote, and I'm sure we'll all try to lobby each other, just as legislators lobby one another and influence one another. Say, here's who I'm voting for, and here's why, and you should too.
Right.
We'll all do a little of that, I'm sure. But and we'll also, I'm sure, be affected by the situation at hand. Once that first ballot goes, then if we go to a second ballot and there's still not a majority, and then you go to a third ballot and there's still not a majority for anyone, then people will start to do some reevaluation, and will they look for an outside candidate? Will they drop one of the candidates? It depends on what the rules do. Now, for example, in South Dakota, when you have a situation, I recall when Governor Janklow, then Congressman Janklow, had his car accident where the motorcyclist was killed and he left Congress, then the methodology by which the Republican candidate for replacement was chosen was very much like this, where delegates were named from each county in South Dakota, and those delegates came together, and we had, 10 candidates, maybe? I'm trying to remember, but certainly more than six or seven. There were quite a few candidates, and we had a ballot, and then we adopted rules at that convention that if a vote was taken and somebody got less than a certain percentage, then they were dropped off the ballot the next vote round. So some of those votes were forced to other candidates. And then in subsequent rounds, we always dropped the lowest vote getter, as I recall, or the lowest two, maybe. I don't remember exactly. But there was a process by which you automatically narrowed the field according to the rules. Now, each convention has a man and a woman. Each state has a man and a woman from the party identified to be on the rules committee. And so we've identified our rules representatives. And I'm trying to remember, I think it's Sandy Kading and David Wheeler. I can't remember, but we've got ours. The Rules Committee will make a judgment about what rules they recommend, and then the entire convention will vote on those rules. Just as the legislature, every year, one of the very first things it does in South Dakota is it adopts its rules. Most of the time the rules are very similar to the prior year's rules, but there's always a tweak or two.
Sure.
So these rules will be offered up. The whole delegation, the entire convention delegate body will vote on those rules, decide on the rules, and then once the voting begins, that voting process will be governed by those rules that we elect for ourselves.
Well, we'll keep following that because it's fairly complex once you get into the weeds there a little bit, yes?
It is.
At least for me.
It's very unusual. It's been a long time.
I want to make sure that we get to talk about something we talked about last time you and I sat down together in Pierre, which was State Park at Spearfish, and I haven't heard anything about that over the session. Where does that stand right now?
Okay, well, one thing that has happened since you and I last spoke about it is we have identified a number of parcels of land that is in state hands, generally school and public lands, owns property, and they might be held for lease, and then the rent is used to provide money for school districts. Those state lands would be, in our plan, swapped for federal lands that surround the state lands that we own right there around what's called Latch String Inn in Spearfish Canyon. So just to refresh your memory, we've got maybe, I can't remember the number exactly, around 200 acres or so of land that the state either owned or just acquired, literally just acquired within the last few months. And one of the parcels that we just acquired is the land over which a Spearfish Falls flows. And so in the past, that had been owned by Homestake, and for a while, the public had access. More recently, the public had no access to it. Now the state owns that land. And so the first thing we're going to do right now, literally within the next couple of months, is we're going to rebuild the trail and the bridge over Spearfish Creek that leads to the falls.
Okay. Yeah.
So sometime later this year, the public will be able to get to the base of Spearfish Falls and enjoy the view there.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, we've also identified these parcels of land that the state owns that we propose to swap. And Senator John Thune is drafting legislation that describes the legal descriptions of the land we propose to swap and the legal description of the land that we propose to get in return as part of the swap. And so hopefully that legislation can make its way through Congress and be signed by the president sometime this year. So, and at that point, then we'll take more action to do more within the park than just create this trail.
The next steps. So, Governor Dugard, a lot of people are already speculating about who might want to take your place in 2019. Kristi Noem is on that short list of what people are talking about. Have you had any thoughts about taking her place in Congress when you're all done as in the governor's mansion?
Well, Linda says it would not be with my current wife.
We've cleared it up, right?
Yeah, right there. There's the
That's
answer.
All we needed to know. Sir, thank you so much for joining us today. You've been very generous with your time.
You're welcome. It was great to be with you.
You've been listening to Governor Dennis Dugard. He is the governor of South Dakota. He joined us today from Pierre.